Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors. Close the blinds. Change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This podcast is produced and hosted by Chris Carr.
On today's podcast, I'm joined by Dr. James Giordano. Dr. Giordano served as the consulting neuroscientist on research into the original cases of Havana Syndrome. On this episode, we look at directed energy and how it affects the brain. Just before we begin, if you're enjoying this podcast, please consider supporting us directly by becoming a Patreon subscriber. All you need to do is just go to patreon.com/secretsandspies. And depending on which level you pick, you'll get a free coaster or coffee cup. And also you'll get access to our Patreon exclusive show, Extra Shot, which comes out twice a month after every espresso martini. I hope you find this interesting and thank you for listening. Take care.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
Dr. James Giordano, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here, and thanks for your interest in my work.
Always, thank you. It's great to have you on. For the benefit of the listeners, please can you just tell us a bit about yourself and your professional experience?
Yeah, sure. So I'm the Pellegrino Center Professor of Neurology and Biochemistry and Director of the Subprogram Military Medical Ethics at Georgetown University Medical Center and School of Medicine in Washington, D.C. And I also serve as the Executive Director of the Institute for Biodefense Research, which is a federally funded think tank here in the greater D.C. area. It's dedicated to looking at those issues of the way that biological, chemical, and radiological devices, techniques could be leveraged in ways that affect global public health.
Thank you for that. I brought you on today because I want to have a chat about Havana Syndrome, because there's been a 60 Minutes documentary that just came out a couple of weekends ago, and there's been obviously a lot of talk about it. And I wanted to kind of get an idea of the sort of science behind it all, because it's all, to some people, the whole idea of directed energy weapons and things sounds almost the realm of science fiction, but it really isn't anymore. So what I'll do, I'll first of all ask you just to give us kind of an overview about the Havana Syndrome attacks and some of the sort of symptoms experienced by victims, just for people who are not totally familiar with all of that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think also, let me refer your listeners and your listening audience to a wonderful, wonderful broadcast that was aired about a year and a half ago, and that was on CNN, and that was the work of the investigative medical reporter Sanjay Gupta, Dr. Sanjay Gupta. And Dr. Gupta did a wonderful job in terms of the due diligence of dealing with some of the individuals who were affected, dealing with particular entities within the National Institutes of Health, the National Academies. I think that really also provides a very, very nice basis for understanding that when coupled to the 60 Minutes reports, really place connect the dots quite well. As relate to these devices, let's not call them weapons. Let's just call them devices, because I think weapons brings on a particular, one can infer certain things about weapons. And I don't think that's necessarily an incorrect inference. If we're going to call them weapons, let's be very general. A weapon is anything that can be used to affect another. In other words, to change that other's bellicose intention, aggressiveness, etc. In other words, they're means of contending against others. And again, these can run the spectrum for things that can make other individuals your friends to things that can actually be injurious, if not mortal, to others. So the issue here is, what might these individuals in Havana been exposed to? We did a number of things. When I was first brought on in late 2016, early 2017 as the consulting neuroscientist, I was presented with about 24 case files. These were individuals who had originally presented to their healthcare providers in Cuba, and then ultimately triaged to the care of Dr. Michael Hofer in Florida. Each and all of these individuals presented with a very, very discrete set of subjective symptoms and objective signs. And interestingly, one of the important dynamics is that these individuals had been on the job for a long time. These were not individuals who were naive to the job. They were not individuals who were new on the job. They were experienced intelligence operators who were under the employ and within service of the Department of State at the U.S. Embassy in Havana. Point number one. Point number two, these were also individuals who had no apparent and or divulged secondary or tertiary gain. They were not looking to come off the job. They were not looking to transfer. They were good at their job, and they wanted to continue doing the job. And each and all of these individuals presented with what we call this constellation of features, subjectively and objectively, that were in fact debilitating to them, to the point where they were no longer able to perform their job satisfactorily. And it was also a disruption of their activity of daily living. They complained of pain in the head, ringing in the ears, disorientation, vertigo, upset stomach, as well as the inability to not only concentrate and focus, but also to simply do the basic tasks of their job. And any kind of multitasking was impossible. As well, they exhibited motoric balance effects, loss of fine and gross motor control. And this was highly disruptive and in some cases actually destructive to their capability to function. Interestingly as well, they did not discuss this among themselves at that time. And that's an important consideration, I think, that needs to be maintained. So the idea of what we'll call communicative cross-contamination was not a factor. They only became aware of the fact that their colleagues had been affected after they had been triaged to Florida. At that point, that's, oh, you're here too, so to speak. But what's really important is, you know, subjective symptoms can occur due to a range of factors. And again, the subjectivity is the key point there. But objective findings using very specific clinical tests within very precise parameters are very difficult, if not impossible, number one, to fake. And number two, are very elucidative of patterns. And what we saw was that there were very, very similar patterns, again, within a range of individual variation of individuals' particular unique physiologies and how people respond to things. But it was clearly indicative that something had happened to these individuals. Is it possible that it may have been something psychogenic or sociogenic? Yes, that's always a possibility. Let's face it. No one is immune, irrespective of what everyone's background, experience, etc. No one is immune. But again, there are a number of factors that contribute to this type of psychogenicity or sociogenicity. And number one, not all and each of them were present. And number two, it didn't fit that pattern. The other issue is when you actually look at the very, very specific objective features that were evaluated, both acutely and then subacutely, again, these are not things that can be faked. That's not to say that if an individual presents with what used to be called a psychosomatic disorder or a functional neurological disorder, there aren't expressive outpourings of this. I mean, there aren't measurable features. In fact, there are. However, there were some very, very discrete factors that dealt with these individuals. They were particular individuals doing a particular job at a particular site. And so that was the first phase of what we might call the populational pattern or the subject pattern. Is it possible, for example, that something happened to these individuals on the job based upon something they were doing? Well, the process that I engaged was a process called abductive forensics. In other words, these are the signs and symptoms you're presented with. And then what types of things could cause this? And I was also afforded the opportunity to engage, again, working under strict HIPAA controls with anonymity, these individuals' medical files, their metadata, as well as data about the environment, the architectures, the geographies, etc. So it was initially considered, well, what types of things could do this? And from the types of things that are possible, what types of things would be most probable? The methods that were used that I employed at that time were well-accepted and standardized methods that are still used to date. They're methods that are used for presumptive risk evaluation, for example, within the Department of Defense and within the Veterans Administration here in the United States and elsewhere. If individuals are suspected to be exposed to something during some type of occupational employ or some type of domiciliary engagement or whatever. In other words, how do we determine if an individual may have been exposed to something? And the actual methods are what we call the EPCOTS method and use of modified Bradford Hill criteria, which allow for consideration of, is the thing that we're considering real? Is it there? What are its known effects? What are its effects in humans? What are the effects that we're seeing in these individuals? Could this individual have been exposed to this? Where? How? Etc. So it's a multifactorial and multi-criterial analytic and assessment method. And you rule things out as well as rule things in. What kind of things could have done this? Well, the first thing you consider is, might they have been exposed to something environmentally? I mean, realistically, they're living out on the economy. A number of things could have affected them, anything ranging from household chemicals, paints, industrial sprays, occupational exposures, environmental exposures, pesticides, pollen, fungi. Each and all of these were examined in relative detail and ruled out. I mean, certainly it represented a probability, but the possibility was very, very low, if not close to zero. And the reason for that, once again, is it didn't fit the pattern. These were specific individuals. Again, if this was something environmental, if this was something within the domicile, more broadly, you would have seen a broader pattern of exposure. You wouldn't have just seen key individuals being affected by this in a very selective and very, if you will, precise and specific way. As well, if they had been exposed to these types of things, there would have been artifacts. It would have been artifacts of these substances, both in the environment, and there were evaluations of that, and there were none. And there would have been artifacts of these things on these people or in these people. In other words, there would have been traceable artifacts, and there certainly were none. Moreover, the dose necessary to be able to incur these effects had been considerable. And at those doses necessary to incur these effects, you would have seen other effects. You would have seen other manifestations, physiological, pathological manifestations, and those were not seen. So we ruled those possibilities out. Is it possible that they may have been exposed to a drug or some drug-food interaction? Again, working through all those possibilities, yes, there are a number of drugs that could cause these types of things, both subjectively and objectively. But here again, the dosimetry necessary to do this would have been quite different. You would have needed a larger dose of the drug or a more durable dose of the drug over a longer period of time. You would have seen other effects produced by these drugs, as side effects that would have been both norm and abnorm. And you also would have had recovery of certain metabolites of the drug, which of course this was not the case. So we can rule out a drug. Is it also possible that perhaps there may have been some other factor, some other environmental factor? Bacteria, virus, fungus. Yes, particularly looking on the fungal side, that may have been a factor, but here once again, you would have seen other signs and symptoms, and there would have been other attributes and or artifacts that would have been retrievable geographically. We rule that out. Well, what else could have occurred? Well, certainly we recognize that another possibility is these individuals may have been exposed to some technology that may have had an adverse effect. And again, this was not unknown. This was not sort of reaching into the realm of the impossible, the improbable, or the untenable. We know, based upon existing evidence and based upon the technological readiness level of these types of technologies, that various forms of radio frequency, rangeable acoustics, and ultrasonics can produce an unusual constellation of features if individuals are exposed to them directly, in other words, downrange, and or if they're exposed to them orthogonally or repeated over a long period of time. Is it therefore possible that these individuals may have been using something on their job site, some form of surveillance equipment, some form of technological disruptive equipment, or simply been exposed to some form of equipment or technology within their job site that had a latent effect that therefore became manifest when they were at home? Yeah, certainly a possibility. So it was then further explored, well, what kind of things were these individuals using on the job? And again, here's where things get a little ambiguous in what can be discussed in an open forum or not. Suffice it to say that what I was then informed is that no, these individuals were not utilizing something on the job that would have incurred these effects. Is it possible that this may still be the case, that there was something there on the job that, for whatever reason, I was not briefed into that compartment, therefore I did not have that need to know? Yes, absolutely. Does the United States possess devices that can be used for surveillance or communications disruption that function within the ultrasonic and rangeable acoustics domains? Yes, absolutely. Are we the only country that possesses these devices and has ongoing research, development, test, evaluation, and use? No. We know that our Trans-Pacific peer competitor and our transatlantic peer competitor has evidentiary, long-standing, and well-documented research, development, test, evaluation, and ongoing employment of such devices for a variety of different applications. Occupational safety and testing, occupational uses, as well as potential dual usability. In other words, these things can be used in national security, intelligence, and defense operations, again, as means of surveillance and surveillance disruption, and as means of communication disruption. Is it therefore possible that these individuals in Havana were exposed to this type of technology, either as being, again, downrange of a surveillance operation or a technical disruption operation, some combination of both, that then incurred this artifactual side effect that was physiologically disruptive? Absolutely, and of high probability. Could it also be possible that this may have represented a direct targeting of these individuals to incur some biologic or physiological disruption? Yes, that's possible as well. So in terms of the probabilities that we then came up with as a consequence of this very precise process of abductive forensics and presumptive risk evaluation, we were able to rule out toxins, drugs, chemical exposures, environmental exposures, fungi, bacteria, viruses. We then considered, is it possible that there may have been some accidental exposure to perhaps an ultrasonic device? And here, one of the things that became important for us is that these types of ultrasonic devices are easily purchased. I mean, these are available direct to consumer. For example, now one can go to a resource like the Sharper Image here in the United States and just look up ultrasonic household protectants, and they're used to repel small mammals and vermin, but they're also used to repel potential intruders. And the technology exists. One of the primary patents for rangeable acoustic and ultrasonic devices was filed here in the United States in 2004, and the patent was then commercialized through something known as a CRADA, and a number of companies picked that up, and the initial device did not have an auditory signature. But when commercialized and for safety purposes, the auditory signature component was then added to these devices. Well, is it possible that these individuals in Havana were exposed to some kind of anti-vermin protection device that may have been installed in their domicile to keep them free of pests? Absolutely. Absolutely. And we then assessed and evaluated things like custodial chains, purchasing chains, installation records, extallation records. Nothing. Nothing. So the idea that this may have been an accidental or artifactual exposure to what might have been, for example, environmental protection through the use of ultrasonics, well, we rule that out. So what we have at that point, what we had is the most probable resource was that, in fact, these individuals had been exposed to some form of acoustic and or ultrasonic device or exposure technology that was consequential to a variety of particular purposes and intents. Surveillance and communications disruption, or direct human factor effect. What became interesting is at the time, we also considered the possibility of some form of electromagnetic exposure. We were considering, for example, radar or some other form of radar-based or sonar-based detection, primarily radar-based. And it's known, for example, that a phenomenon known as the Frey effect can occur, whereby exposure, particularly close-range exposure to radar pulses, can have a disruptive effect on human physiology. Was it possible, then, that these individuals may have been exposed to some form of radar or similar electromagnetic pulsatile device? Yeah, it's certainly possible. And we know that the effects there are multifold. They're primarily functional effects in disrupting the actual functional capability of a physiological system, particularly a conductive physiological system, like the neurological system, whereby the actual function of that system is contingent upon sort of electrochemical interactions, where you then get network effects in the, if you will, chain of network activity that is the nervous system, and other effects on a body as well. But again, I mean, the issue there would be that the type of device necessary to do that would certainly not be inconspicuous. I mean, this would require a fairly large and rather evident radar dish. So it's not something they wouldn't have thought, well, yeah, I saw this thing, didn't think two things of it. Next thing you know, I'm getting these effects. Point number one. Point number two is we also considered, well, could it also have been some form of microwave device? But we ruled that out early on because here again, the technology necessary to be able to allow a sustained delivery of a directable microwave has three basic limitations. Number one, it requires a lot of power. Number two, the power source necessary to drive that and sustain that power is in fact quite large. Number three, that would render that device, I mean, possibly fieldable and operationalizable, but very conspicuous. The other thing is when you're delivering that level of microwave energy, it's going to have a thermal artifact. However, here's the interesting point. Late in 2018 and early in 2019, through ongoing collaborations with another colleague of mine named Professor Idil Shamiloglu at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque, who was also involved in some work with this project, it became apparent that the current state of technological readiness of very rapidly pulsed microwaves was sufficiently advanced to allow these to be scaled and therefore render them fieldable and potentially operationalizable, point number one. Point number two was that the research, development, test, evaluation, and limited applications in real-world use of such rapidly pulsed microwaves was already underway and was already occurring, not only in the United States, but also among our international peer competitors, most notably our Trans-Pacific competitor. And much of the iterative research that has led to this has occurred by our transatlantic peer competitor. My ongoing work with Professor Shamiloglu became far more aware of not only the technological readiness level of rapidly pulsed microwaves, but also of the actual capability and the technology necessary to do that. And the linchpin, the key factor here, is the actual temporality, the time span of the pulse. It needs to be very, very, very quick. But the use of lasers to rapidly pulse the microwave and perhaps to also provide some chaperoning effect in terms of directing the microwave has really been the boon that has allowed these microwaves to be pulsed in very, very rapid scale. In other words, at nanosecond scale, that allows preservation of the microwave form, but doing so quickly reduces the thermal artifact effect. In other words, they're not heat generative. And number two also reduces the power requirement that renders this to be very, very scalable, ergo, fieldable and operationalizable. Is it possible then that given this technology readiness level and the reality of these devices, that this too could have been a possibility, if not probability? So our addended report in 2018, early 2019, included the high possibility, if not probability, of the viable use of a scalable microwave, rapidly pulsed microwave, either in tandem with some form of rangeable acoustic ultrasonic device, or in some combination of both, either one, then the other, or both together, again, without any presumption or without any attribution as to whether or not that represented a surveillance operation, a surveillance disruption, a communication disruption operation, or in fact, there was explicit intentionality to incur some form of disruption, if not harm, to human factors involved. So that's where the Havana investigations and analysis led us. Subsequent to Havana, it became noted that there had been other reported cases, and many of those reported cases had a very similar professional profile. Many of those cases entered into what has been colloquially referred to as a verification and validation pipeline. And it takes a fair amount of time, effort, resources, and engagement to be able to determine whether or not there's something there or not. And this takes time. And certainly, individuals were iteratively being fed into that pipeline. As well, I think it's of prime note to your listening audience that there have been literally thousands of reports from individuals who believe they may have been exposed to something of this nature, whether it's directed energy or some type of other neurological device that may have rendered some harmful effect to them. And the vast majority of those cases, I mean, we're talking 99% of those cases, number one, do not fit the pattern. Number two, if in fact there are certain pattern similarities, equivalences that would then incur, well, maybe let's examine this further, have been proven to be something quite different. Realistically, many of them are in fact psycho-associogenic effects based upon the broad spread media outpouring as a consequence of media coverage of Havana syndrome. And, you know, this represents a number of things. I mean, it could be the worried well, individuals who may simply be worried about this kind of thing. Individuals who are conflating signs and symptoms of a pre-existing condition or a very benign condition with these types of things. And in some cases, these are also individuals who have something else going on, some other form of physiological and or medical condition that produces similar signs and symptoms, or in some cases that will produce a constellation of features that would allow them to sort of escalate their presentation. I mean, here we're talking about everything from mild hypochondriasis to something far more severe on the psychological scale. But I think what's happened is that those subsequent cases have certainly muddied the waters a bit. I mean, those cases need to be evaluated, and I'm certainly not saying those individuals don't suffer. They do, and if there's something wrong with them, they require prudent, pragmatic, and durable care. But again, the problem is conflating apples and oranges. So I think what's important sort of as the take-home message is to recognize that the individuals who suffered whatever it was they suffered from, and I am convinced, again, have argued as a scientist, scientists can be wrong all the time, and it's part of the basis of it. But I'm confident the methods that were used, the techniques and tools that were used, given the data and information that were applied and that were available, that the conclusions that I and my group came to initially and then subsequently are in fact sound, that something physical happened to those individuals in Havana. And it is very likely, based upon the information that I've been receiving, that something physical has happened to about 100 other individuals worldwide subsequent to Havana. And that there have been thousands of cases of reports of things from people who believe they have been subjected to something that are quite different and are not representative of what happened in Havana. So that's where we stand today, sir.
Thank you very much for that. That's a very detailed explanation. That's brilliant. And National Academy of Sciences also kind of came to a similar conclusion. Is that right?
That's correct. The Academy report concurred with a number of those initial findings based upon their independent review, not only of my work, but of the actual data pool itself. So this was essentially meta-analytic based upon not only what we had done, but the actual data themselves, inclusive of some of the subsequent cases. So the Academy report was in many ways a report that had co-validation of what we had defined as the most probable resources of what had occurred to the individuals.
Now, I'm very interested in, obviously, the cases that are, should we say, genuine cases that have the symptoms that we're talking about. And I think you just said just now, and it was 60 Minutes also said it was about 100 people have been affected by this, what we call Havana syndrome. And I was wondering if you could talk to me a little bit about some of the specifics of the attack itself, because one of the questions I was kind of puzzled by a little bit was, if it's a directed attack at an individual, can other people also be harmed if they were in the proximity of that person? So should, I don't know, person A is the person as a target, and I happen to be person B standing next to them, is it possible that, you know, I could get injured standing next to person A?
Yeah, the idea of collateral damage. Yeah, certainly. Absolutely. I mean, I think there's a number of variables there, not least of which is the preservation of whatever represents the form of whatever this energy is. In other words, like anything else, I mean, think of a spray of water. If the spray of water is very, very tight, then clearly whoever you're spraying the water at is going to be the individual who catches the soaking. Is it possible that other people standing around might get droplets or wet? Yeah, sure. But as that water diffuses as a consequence of time, space, exposure, characteristics, and the spray broadens, well, then clearly the effects are going to broaden. By the same token, the more concentrated the effect, the more durable or the more severe is going to be the manifestation. So you may be seeing a spectrum of effect by individuals who are nearby. But let me back up just a bit. I personally don't refer to these things as attacks, because I think once you say that, you then begin to incur some intent that the issue here may represent something directly against the human factor itself. That does not fall within my purview. That's a decision that others need to make. My thought is that these represent exposures to some form of energy source that may be a directable energy source that could be used for a variety of things. Again, surveillance, technical disruption, and of course, to incur some form of personal disruption, bodily disruption, and physical harm. But once you cross that threshold into presumptive intentionality that this is being used to incur physical harm, that can be interpreted in a number of ways that are relevant to national security, intelligence, and defense, and that also then incurs, I think, a response posture that would very importantly be seen as appropriate. In other words, now we're looking at proportionality of response based upon intent. So we have to be very, very cautious in causing these things true attacks against persons if, in fact, we're also considering that the effect against persons or on persons may be artifactual to some type of directed operation that is a surveillance operation or a disruptive operation against some form of communication technology or some other. So again, here, I think that a bit of caution goes a long way with regard to the prudence of what might be the implications and manifestations of using the word attack.
Yes. Okay. What I'm quite interested as well is, you were touching upon it a bit earlier about the types of devices out there. How do, if I call it a directed energy device, how does that device affect the brain?
Well, it depends on what the energy is. So our initial consideration was, well, knowing that there is, again, a high level of technological readiness, application, and use of sonic devices.
Yeah.
How do sonic devices, particularly ultrasonic devices, affect physiological tissues? Well, it can do so in a number of ways. I mean, clearly one of the things that ultrasonic devices can do is they create an impact in a fluid medium or a semi-fluid medium. So what they'll do is, I mean, take, for example, a loudspeaker, one of your sound speakers, and put it over water. And really crank that loudspeaker up, and you'll see there's going to be a rippling effect in the water. That's called a cavitation effect. And that cavitation effect is not just a rippling, but it also incurs sort of a turbulence. So it creates this turbulent flow or turbulent disruption within fluid media. Okay, we know that. Well, fluid media are abundant in the human body. Our cells are predominantly composed of fluid, and there are a number of organs that utilize various types of fluid, lymphatic fluid, endolymph fluid, as the media in which their cells operate. So, for example, the hearing organ of the inner ear, the balance organs of the middle ear, a number of hollow organs that utilize fluid exchange, probably most notably blood. And so impacting those organs by creating disrupted flow, where you usually have fairly linear, fairly smooth flow, that now you get turbulence, not only creates problems with regard to the fluid media themselves, in other words, you now have like a bubbling, roiling kind of effect in the fluid that therefore disrupts whatever is going to be the cellular activities of things surrounding or using that fluid as the medium, but can also then incur an effect against the walls around which that fluid are housed or incur or exist. So, I mean, think of a container. So now what you're doing is you're getting a turbulence effect on the container. But please understand, the container and these living tissues are exactly that. They're living cells that can also respond to changes in pressure, in smoothness of flow, in overall activity level, in the interaction between the fluid medium and the cellular medium, which can then cause these cells to fire in an abnormal pattern, in a disruptive pattern. And this then creates, if you will, a chain effect. So you have two media by which these sonic exposures or sonic stimuli can affect biological tissues. One is by virtue of fluid disruption, again, across a range of fluid medium that are certainly transferable along the fluid media themselves. In other words, within whatever's going to be that receptacle of the fluid, and or if we're talking about a piping system like the bloodstream, it can actually induce sort of a turbulent flow in blood. And or the tissues that house these fluids. So taken together, what you're getting is a potentially disruptive effect, particularly if, number one, the stimulus is strong enough, and number two, the stimulus is durable enough. So what are we talking about here? Well, to sort of bring it over the finish line, so to speak, we're talking about an effect that could cause disruption of the balance organs of the inner ear by disrupting the fluid media of the inner ear, and also the cells that are the stimulus transmitting cells of the inner ear, the balance and hearing organs, that are then transmitting those signals to the brain. If you overexcite those networks enough, you then create something called an overexcitation effect. And basically what you do is you sort of overpower the system. I mean, basically you kind of, quote, short the system out, and I'm being very colloquial. The actual word for this is that you get an increase sort of increase in calcium conductance, and then you get something called calcium excitotoxicity, which can then lead to a change in the function and perhaps even the durability and existence of cells along this pathway. Point number one. Point number two is you can also disrupt the blood flow of the inner ear. And the blood flow of the inner ear communicates with the blood flow of the brain, which then creates turbulent flow in the blood flow to the brain, which then produces something along the lines of a decompression sickness type injury that produces sort of a mini stroke, if you will. So you're getting a functional disruption by virtue of disrupting the neurological activity along this, if you will, chain of neurological command, which can then lead to very durable changes in the way these nodes and networks function, particularly if repetitive. And you can also have structural changes that occur as a consequence of disrupted blood flow, which can then lead to change in tissue integrity, perhaps local areas that look like a microstroke, and you incur structural damage that way. Again, I think it's important to understand that many of these signs and symptoms are very similar to those you'd see with a mild to moderate head injury. And again, harken back, the Havana syndrome was initially referred to as the immaculate concussion. If we examine what happens, however, with electromagnetic energies, it's a little bit different. You have to understand that many of the cells of the human body are what we call electrochemically conductive cells. In other words, they work by changes in chemistries that then induce a change in the ions that these cells use to literally create ionic currents. So they work very similar to the way you would pass an electrical current along a network line. The way this occurs in the brain is not so much sort of toe bone to foot bone to leg bone. It doesn't so much work like a landline, although there are certainly connectivities, but rather it works more like a Wi-Fi system. We've come to realize this over the past 10 years. And so given that, I mean, yes, you need, quote, circuit boards to be able to conduct Wi-Fi type communications. But one of the effects of electromagnetic pulsed energy is that it can disrupt both the functional aspects of those circuits and, to some extent, the circuits themselves, because as certain circuits or nodes and networks will become overexcited, they fuse, whereas others will become disrupted and they will tend to shut off. A simple case in point, and I don't advocate that your listeners do this, is if you take your cell phone, which is essentially working with regard to Wi-Fi communications, in other words, it's not plugged into the wall, it's not a phone line that comes through a set of actual cables. Many of the functions of the brain operate more like Wi-Fi than they do landline telephone. Take your cell phone and put it in the microwave for 2 seconds. And I'm not actually advocating that they do this. Please.
Yeah, don't do that.
But what I'm saying is, if you take the cell phone out, it won't be hot. You won't feel heat. You won't get that thermal artifact, but try to use the cell phone. It might work, but it's certainly not going to work the way it worked before, and it will probably never work the way it worked before again. So what we can find is that exposure to particular patterns, particular, again, characteristic criteria of electromagnetic pulses can disrupt the node network integrity and therefore function of the brain. So if you consider the brain to be similar, akin to the way a cell phone works, I mean, clearly there are mechanical circuits there, there are physical circuits there, but it's working more on sort of a Wi-Fi type arrangement. If you impart a significant electromagnetic pulse, microwave pulse, onto that, quote, circuit board, you're going to disrupt the circuit board. And that's one of the things that we know, that particular forms of directable energies, particularly along the electromagnetic spectrum, are capable of doing with excitable cells, such as those in the nervous system and brain. So again, here you have two viable technologies that currently are in a state of technological readiness for operational deploy that are capable of inducing these possibilities and therefore represent a high probability based upon what it was that we saw both in those individuals in Havana and subsequently those in the validation and verification pipeline.
Thank you for that. One quick note I was just going to add with regards to the cases reported in the 60 Minutes broadcast. Apparently they found evidence of an injury to the auditory and vestibular system of the brain, starting with the inner ear. I don't know if there's anything you want to sort of say on that.
Right. I mean, that is basically corroborating what we had said here earlier,
okay.
that whether it was an acoustic device with an ultrasonic component that would therefore disrupt the fluid medium of the inner ear, both the hearing organ and the balance organ, and then incur damage along, if you will, that labeled line, that neurological network that processes that information, and or some form of directable electromagnetic energy that could also incur damage to the inner ear structures and or the neurological structures, both of the ear and the brain. There's now corroborative evidence to support those findings.
Yeah. Well, let's take a quick break and then we'll be right back. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about who's sort of doing research into this sort of portable energy technology, if I put it that way. You mentioned earlier in New Mexico, your colleague said that there's now scalable tech available, because obviously we're talking about directed energy, well, we call them energy weapons again for a moment. In my mind, as you were saying earlier, you might need something of a big satellite dish and a big power source, but potentially there's technology now that doesn't require such a large power source because it's using, It's using lasers to help sort of pulse the microwave. Is that correct?
That's correct. I mean, again, I think the analogy here is think about when cell phones first came out. I mean, if you remember those first generation cell phones, they were the size of a bread box. I mean, literally, they're the size of a military walkie-talkie. I mean, they're big. And, you know, we say, oh, this is great. There's a portable phone. I mean, but now, as you see, what tends to happen is the technology evolves and the science that feeds that technology evolves, and therefore the technology yields science. The task here is to make things more efficient. And along with that efficiency comes a scalability. So now what we're able to see is that the current iterations of a cell phone are rather compact. Well, this is a tendency that we can then apply analogously to other forms of energetic technology. Again, rangeable acoustics and ultrasonic devices, and certainly microwaves, where we're then acknowledging what the limitations are with regard to scalability and applications in use, and delimiting them by the use of conjoined applications of convergent science and technology.
Which countries are sort of doing research into this sort of technology, and are there any pioneers in it?
Well, again, I mean, I think to reiterate it, it's certainly, we're certainly seeing representative and reflective of the ongoing work of what I'll call the big three. Mm. So the United States and its international scientific, technological, and yes, of course, military allies, as well as our trans-Pacific peer competitor, namely China, and work that had been done in the former Soviet Union that then had carryover and has now been uptaken with specificity in Russia. Here, too, we're seeing these are the big three, if you will. But the consideration here is just because those are the countries that are doing the ongoing research, development, testing, evaluation, and perhaps limited applications of use occupationally, industrially, and perhaps even within the military, that doesn't mean that those are the sources of attribution. And the reason for that is quite simple. I mean, large nations characteristically employ proxies for a variety of things. The United States and its allies certainly have. Historically, we see that. And we know that our trans-Pacific and transatlantic peer competitors also engage proxies, both directly and implicitly. Mm. As well, the technology, if made available either by virtue of plan or the actual widgets themselves, the actual technology, can be uptaken by proxies, which could be non-state actors, that could then leverage these technologies in those ways in very, very asymmetrical engagements to have fairly profound effect, disruptive effect. So again, I think what becomes important to note is that yes, absolutely, the proverbial big three that represent global powers have dedicated research, development, and application efforts in these spaces. But that does not rule out the possibility for other actors obtaining this science or technology, using the science or technology, and using it in a variety of ways that could be capricious or nefarious.
These incidents being on for some time, and potentially up to 100 American personnel have genuinely been infected by these direct energy devices. whether targeted or not, but the US government seems to be sort of playing down the sort of significance of it in its messaging, whilst, you know, obviously in comparison, the 60 Minutes report is quite sort of pointed in believing that it's the Russian government are attacking top tier US personnel. And I was wondering kind of what your thoughts were on that.
Let me back out of that question a bit. So I think there's actually two questions there.
Yeah.
Number one has been, I think, a relative circumspection in certain areas of the United States governmental reports and also disclosures about what these AHIs could represent and the overall tenor of the Havana Syndrome. And the second is this most recent implication or attribution in terms of finger pointing as to the whodunit. They are, in fact, I think, separate issues. Not unrelated, but separate issues, and let's treat them as such. Let us just assume for a moment, without any sense of attribution, that there's a recognition that, number one, these devices exist, which in fact they do. That is a reality. That is a factual reality. Mm. And number two, they're operational, usable, and therefore have validity and value in operational settings, such as those of the individuals who are exposed in Havana and perhaps elsewhere. Again, a factual reality. There's a couple of caveats that go along with that. If, in fact, the United States and or its international allies are employing these devices, well, then frank admission of that in a public forum would also allow frank admission to that among our peer competitors to recognize what the contemporary state of that science and technology is in these operational settings. In other words, you're cracking your playbook, point number one. Point number two, if in fact there is the suspicion and or implications, and perhaps on some levels, factors that would then lead to direct attribution, factual attribution, that it was a peer competitor, well, do you really want to let your peer competitor know that you know what they're doing? Mm. And that you may then be developing particular mechanisms of detection and or mitigation and prevention, because what you're essentially doing there is you're telegraphing, which would then allow your peer competitor to advance their technology in those ways that are going to counter your counters. So there is a bit of the what I'll call cat and mouse that can occur on a number of levels, and certainly those represent viable possibilities. I think another more what I'll call reasonable possibility, not to discount the former and not to say that these two are mutually exclusive, is that I think before there's any real statement of presumptive risk, and that presumptive risk is then expected as definitive exposure, characteristically, that process of validation takes time. Look, I mean, the fact that Dr. Jim Giordano produced a report that was methodologically sound and based upon rigorous criteria, well, that's one thing. But I'm one person dealing with a particular set of cases. And what you want to find is multiple corroborative lines of evidence to be able to support presumptive risk. Certainly the National Academy's report, notable in that regard. But I think here too, you can't extricate one set of factors, in other words, the time, effort, level of information, data, and therefore validation resources necessary to come to presumptive risk of defined exposure from the fact that, well, okay, exposure to what and by whom? Mm. So the intricacy of that relationship, yeah, the devices exist. Yeah, these individuals were very probably exposed to those devices, coupled with the yeah, but the who done it and why they done it creates, I think, a very tenuous set of circumstances that need to be prudently and pragmatically addressed, which I feel in part may be reflective and representative of some of the circumspection in certain aspects of this as this was evolving over the period of time from 2016 to present.
Hmm. I'm going to get us into our sort of final section. I saw you did a very interesting lecture. I actually watched it this morning. I can't say I understood the whole thing, but you had this brilliant lecture called "The Brain is the Battlefield of the Future." And I was wondering if you could just tell us why you consider the brain the battlefield of the future.
Yeah, I mean, so the assertion that the brain represents the 21st century battlescape is based upon what I feel are three convergent lines of realistic and factual evidence. Mm. Number one, the more we learn about any biological system, the more we recognize both its capabilities and its vulnerabilities. And certainly, if we take a look at the latter part of the 20th century, we can ideally look at that and say, this has been sort of the half century of the neurosciences. Mm. I mean, the neurosciences as a titular field arose in the late 70s, and that concatenation of ideas, of constructs, of innovation, realistically led to a bow wave of activity, looking at the brain as, if you will, one of the final exploratory frontiers. And so we're learning a lot more about brain structure and function. And of course, we're also developing a whole host of tools to be able to assess the brain, to access the brain, and to affect the brain. And the specificity, the precision, the sophistication, the granularity of those tools render them highly dually usable. But moreover, take a look at the organ that those tools are affecting and assessing. That organ, that brain, as it is embodied in that individual who is embedded within whatever environments they're in, is at very, very least an important component of our thoughts, our emotions, our decisions, our behaviors, and our identities. And so being able to affect that, being able to assess that in ever-increasing and sophisticated ways that allow relatively remote effects that can then be incurred on some very subtle scales that can have rippling implications as relate to individual and group interactions, cognitions, feelings, actions and activities. Well, there's a lot of power there, a tremendous amount of power. And so what we're seeing is that the toolkit of the brain sciences renders these tools exceedingly dually usable. So here we're looking at things like certainly new drugs, the development and identification of new bugs, whether these bugs be viruses, bacteria, fungi. They can be modifications of existing entities and/or creation of those things anew, as COVID taught us. The idea that we could perhaps manipulate certain organisms, even in those ways that are necessary to explore how gain of function may allow these organisms to become more mutable, more transmissible. I'm not saying that COVID was a biological weapon. There is nothing to my evidence or the history that I have seen that indicates that it was. But certainly there are strong indications to suggest that the gain of function research that was deemed to be necessary to explore the vulnerability of human populations to potential modifications and mutations of the SARS-CoV virus that were environmentally present in Wuhan, coupled with some inadequacy of the biosafety levels of the laboratory for early stages of modification of that, allowed a modified virus to escape back into the wild. And although the modified virus itself may have been very benign, its escape back into the wild form under particular ecological conditions allowed for a trajectory of mutation and mutagenicity that then led to the zoonotic spread that we now know as COVID. But that could be intentionalized as well. The use of gene editing, the use of synthetic biology, the use of developing an iterative and combinatory toolkit to assess the brain from a distance, for example, and to also access the brain and affect the brain from a distance. It's profound. And what that then allows is a toolkit that enables, if you will, access to the functions of the brain, which cumulatively and colloquially refer to as mind. Could that be a form of mind reading? Well, literally reading, taking signs and symbols and providing that interpretive meaning based upon some codified pattern. Yeah, absolutely. Could we then also target the brain directly, as I said, through bugs and drugs, through modified toxins, through devices, through data? Yeah, we could do it directly and we can do it indirectly by changing the way the brain responds to what we now understand to be narratives, symbols, by understanding the way individual and collective brains process this information and respond to this information when coupled to big data, when coupled to machine learning, to AI, to ubiquitous forms of media that are available, can be then used to leverage various opinions and perspectives of individuals and populations. The targetability of the brain, both in terms of its neurological substrates and neurological structures and functions, and those functions, as we know, of cognitions, emotions, and behaviors, profound. Profound.
Thank you for that. As we wrap up, is there anything else that you would like to add before we part company today that's important to you?
I think we've covered a lot, but I think that perhaps the take-home message here is not just to your listening audience, but to up the chain of those levels of politics that help to protect the polis that is your listening audience. I mean, we need to take a very factual recognition of what science and technology is out there. And although we'd like to think that the low-hanging fruit for the development and use of that science and technology is for benevolent aims and means, you know, what we, whoever we are, consider to be good may not be the same as what they, whoever they are, to consider to be good. And let's face it, every application of science and technology for a group's national security, intelligence, and defense is done under the idea of, yes, we're protecting what we hold to be good. We're advancing what we hold to be good. So understanding the science and technology and understanding the human condition and how we appropriate goods and how we use science and technology to defend and advance what we hold to be good, I think certainly is going to necessitate a much more granular and at the same time expansive and comprehensive address of the way that these emerging sciences and technologies can be and will be used in these various agenda.
Where can listeners find out more about you and your work?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, they could go to the Georgetown website. That's www.georgetown.edu. And just type in my faculty name there, Dr. James Giordano, and you can get an ongoing view of my work. And or they could contact me and view me from the ongoing work at the Institute for Biodefense Research here in the United States. And once again, that's www.biodefenseresearch.org.
Dr. Giordano, thank you very much for your time today and for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you so much for your interest in my work. Thanks for listening.
Listening. This is Secrets and Spies.